Blog Talk Radio.
Brooke Shem, this is Mark Lichtenwalter coming to you live with another episode of Fundamentally Mormon. We are going to be continuing reading as it is translated correctly by Ogden Kraut, and we are in Chapter 3. Let's see here, translating and revising scripture. So anybody can call in with any questions or comments after the reading, or to listen online, like my wife is listening as she's driving today. The guest call-in number is 917-889-8827. That's 917-889-8827. Hello, Kim.
Hi.
Are you there?
I was muted.
Hi.
Yeah, can you hear me? I muted myself
yeah.
So that there was no weird noises.
Okay. I'll just read, and then since it's just text pretty much that's history and all that, so I'll just start with the reading, and then if you have anything to say, you can just say it. Anybody who does want to find these radio shows can find them at Zion's Redemption Bookstore on Facebook. It's a page on Facebook that I've created where I put the text down for each show, and I also post some of my old shows from The Kingdom of God or Nothing, which you can find on iTunes. And also at blogtalkradio.com/The Kingdom of God or Nothing. Chapter 3, Translating and Revising Scriptures of As It Is Translated Correctly. Oh, also before we begin, in case you haven't heard me 1,000 times before, well, I guess new listeners may not have, but you can read these texts or these books for free online at ogdenkraut.com. That's O-D-G-E-N. KRAUT.com. Scroll down on the main page to read Ogden's books, and then click on that link, and it is the first book, and I'll get your page number here in a minute. I think we're on page 21, but I can't remember. Anyway, I'm going to read it. As soon as I get to a page number, I'll let you know. All right. Too often overzealous and misinformed preachers of today profess to have a Bible without error. However, any honest Christian scholar would admit mistakes and inaccuracies in all Bible translations. Perhaps the erudite scholar of the Bible history said it best when they declared, quote, "The need for the New Testament textual criticism results from a combination of three factors. Number one, the originals, probably written on papyrus scrolls, have all perished," because papyrus actually disintegrates after a couple hundred years, I think it is. Number two, for over 1,400 years, the New Testament was copied by hand, and the copyists, scribes, made every conceivable error, as well as at time intentionally altering, probably with the idea of correcting the text. So the Gutenberg press wasn't invented until the late 1300s, I believe. So like for, you know, all those years, all they could do was copy by hand, which is fine. Well, it's fine if you're a Hebrew, you know, and you're writing in Hebrew, because apparently they counted their letters, and if they were off, they'd have to go and find where the error was, and if there was an error, they'd just throw away the, you know, the what they were recording it on and start over again, but that's not how the Christians did it. So such errors and alterations survived in various ways, with the basic tendency to accumulate. Scribes seldom left anything out, lest they omit something inspired. So basically, If a former scribe wrote a note on the side, a later scribe would add it into the text. There are now extant, in whole or in part, 5,338 Greek Masoretic texts, as well as hundreds of copies of ancient translations, counting over 8,000 copies in the Latin Vulgate, plus the evidences from citation of the New Testament in writings of the early church fathers. Moreover, there are no two of these texts anywhere in existence are exactly alike. End quote. Biblical Criticisms by Harris, Walk, Guthrie, and Fee. I guess that's the name. Page 128. This is not the overwhelming evidence as to the accuracy and harmony of the Bible, which our modern divines proclaim, but rather the understanding of scholarly and qualified textual critics. The translators themselves are responsible for most of the errors in the Bible, so we must look to where and how they came about. There is a definite need for textual critics and for the exposure of errors that they find, page 21. Of as it is translated correctly. The principal errors in translation can be classified into three main categories. Number one, changes in words, numbers, and dates. Number two, inconsistencies within the history. And number three, contradictions in its teachings. Summarized in this chapter are 41 of the main problems encountered in making a correct translation of the Bible from ancient manuscripts. Number one, language transmission. To begin with, the translation of any ancient language into another cannot be absolutely accurate regardless. Oh, I'm having a hard time. Oh. Of how well versed the scribe may be, scholars all agree that even certain features of the Greek syntax and vocabulary are difficult or impossible to convey in translation, which is the language of the New Testament. Number two, word transmission. Anyone familiar with foreign languages knows that many words in a language cannot be directly changed into words of another language with exactly the same meaning. Every language has its own word peculiarities, which are often very difficult, if not impossible, to change into another language. Number three, homonym errors. In every language, there are words that sound alike but mean different things. Some examples in English are words that mean beat, B-E-A-T, and beat, B-E-E-T, or a person could saw a log or he saw a prayed. Whole is written for whole, W-H-O-L-E, as opposed to H-O-L-E. It is it, which is, you know, without the apostrophe.
There is on that too.
Yeah, I'm just going to skip all of these because I think that they made the point.
Yeah.
So anyway, all these words are mistakenly used interchangeably because of the similarities of sound. These and similar homonyms have been frequently found in Bible translations. Page 22, number 4, haplography errors. This means writing once what should have been written twice. This has occurred in the Bible with letters, words, and portions of sentences. Number 5, dittography errors. This is a common transcriptural error, writing twice what should be written only once. This error has been noted in Ezekiel, Isaiah, Psalms, and other early manuscripts, but many later translations have corrected the error when written in the English. Number 6, metathesis. This is the inadvertent exchange of the proper order of letters or words and it can significantly change the meaning. In Isaiah 32:19, it originally read, "The forest will fall," end quote. Instead, it was incorrectly translated, "The city is leveled," end quote. In Ezekiel 42:16, the original number was obviously wrong and had to be translated or corrected by translators to read 500 rather than 5 cubits. Number 7, fusion. This is combining the last letter of the first word with the first letter of the following word. In Hebrews, this can be done and has been a serious error. Fission. This is the improper separation of one word into two words. This has been found in verses such as Isaiah 61:1, with the last word in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 20, and also in other places. Number 9, page 23. Misreading handwriting. I am so tired.
Yeah, you probably should be done.
I can't. I have to do the radio show.
I understand, but also, are the kids all ready, and have you been making sure that they're getting done? Like, Emmett, does he have product in
their
hair?
The kids are wandering around getting their stuff and getting things, and I will finish when I get off the phone with you when you get to your school. So as soon as you get to your school, I will walk around and make sure the kids have all of their things, and they will be fine.
Okay. I'm in helper.
Well, stop driving so fast.
I'm not.
Oh, did you see that? I'm not getting off topic. I'm sorry. I'm going to continue reading. In nearly all languages, there are several letters which are similar in appearance and are easily mistaken. Anciently, this was a problem because of poor writing materials and variations of handwriting. Age of manuscripts would mar or obliterate important letters or words, making it difficult to know what was written. That's one thing that I hate about the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's so many portions of it that have holes or they're worn out and you can't read it. Then, like, there's really, really important stuff in the Dead Sea Scrolls and really interesting, and then you get to a point where you're like, okay, you can't even read this part, so you have to skip over a whole bunch of stuff and get to the next part when they're building up to something, and all of a sudden it's gone. You know, it's like, oh, it drives me nuts, especially when I read about the last prophet. Sun, product in your hair, and deodorant under your pits. I don't see the product in your hair. Anyway, getting back to the radio show. This is what being a dad in the morning consists of. Trying to do the radio show, trying not to fall asleep because you drove all night long, trying to make sure the kids are doing what they need to do. Oh, man. I might just have to go way more part-time with my job because I don't know how I'm going to keep up this pace. Maybe things will settle. Anyway, misreading the handwriting and copying even the same language is easily done. In the Hebrew writing, this is a particularly common problem. Number 10, homoletelion. That's an interesting word. This Greek word means having the same ending. Oh, hey, isn't that great? Why don't they just say having the same ending instead of making it into a Greek word? Anyway, sometimes a loss of text can result when the eye of the copyist passes over all the words preceding a final phrase, which may be identical with one which closes the sentence preceding it and following after it. These have been found in Isaiah, Psalms, and elsewhere. Oh, there's another Greek word that I don't want to read. Homoiokaton. Does this sound right, Kim? No, Emmett.
I don't know.
You
I don't
cannot
speak
see
Greek.
The word. It's Greek to me. This means that which has a similar meaning. Oh, that's nice. Why don't they just say that? Are you leaving now on that?
No, I'm getting my hair
done. Okay, go put the stuff in your hair and brush your teeth. This, too, involves losses of intervening words as the eye of the scribe jumps from one beginning to another. This is often a situation which has caused the loss of the substantial number of words in the translation. Number 12, omission of words. This is an occasional loss of a word because it was accidentally missed or because it was unreadable and purposely left blank. Such an example was Samuel. 1 Samuel. Okay.
Is that what you said?
Yeah. 1 Samuel 13, verse 1, which in the MSS, Masoretic, I think, said Saul was blank years old when he began to reign. This was filled in by scholars who used clues and calculations to provide the omitted information, whether correct or incorrect. In some instances, this is impossible to do accurately. So we don't actually know how old Samuel was. That's interesting.
I just wanted to say that's also another one of those words, rain and rain.
Oh, yeah. Number 13, dead language words. Some Hebrew words are not known in today's language, even to Jewish scholars. For instance, the creature mentioned in Deuteronomy 14, 5, and 6, which I think is Leviathan, if I remember right, and the disease in Deuteronomy 28, 22, or the names of the stones in Exodus 28 are all part of a lost or dead language. Number 14, absence of vowels. The vowels and consonants of Hebrew were not in the language of the Bible. Thus, it is easy to understand how a word could have been interpreted differently. That's actually relevant. They didn't invent vowel markers until after the destruction of the Second Temple, and the only reason they did that was because they knew they were being dispersed among the nations and they didn't want to lose the understanding. But there are things, even in the Tanakh, that were still mistranslated. So you can have three consonants in the Hebrew language, and it could mean different things. Like the word for Isha, I can't remember how to spell that in Hebrew, but like if you have the same three letters that mean fire or woman. And in Ezekiel 36 or 37 or 38, it talks about the fire within the lead jar. Well, they've also translated that as the evil woman in the lead jar. And it's like, no, I can understand fire because of nuclear fire. But anyway, so like basically just take out all the vowels of your English words and then sometimes you're going to have like the same consonants, but you don't have the vowels. Well, it's a big pain. But the Hebrew language didn't actually add vowels until after the Second Temple was destroyed, and it was done by the Nazarites, or not the Nazarites, the...
I don't even know what a vowel Nazarene is. Is it those little umlaut things, or...?
So, like with the Tetragrammaton, you've got four letters, and everybody... in original Hebrew, and actually, it's not even original Hebrew, it's the Babylonian Hebrew. So you'll have vowel markers to help you to learn how to, or to tell you how to pronounce the name of God, or the Tetragrammaton. Mm-hmm. Somebody posted a thing showing it to me. I know. Anyway, so they put little ticks and things underneath or up above it or beside it to help you to know how to pronounce the consonant. But it's interesting because in Hebrew, there's actually some letters in Hebrew that were used as vowels in ancient Hebrew, but mm-hmm. I'm not really familiar with. I've listened to scholars talk about it, but I don't know.
Okay.
Very
well,
much
Pat,
about
I
that.
Have to go. Sorry, I've been sitting here, but I wanted to know what that was about.
Okay. Well, you can. My wife has to go, so she can listen to this later, and I'll finish. I'll find a place to stop here with reading. But love
okay.
you, Kim.
Love you.
And
later.
call me when you get off of work.
Okay.
Even if I'm sleeping.
Okay.
Okay.
Please
bye.
Don't forget Olivia's note. Okay.
All right. So if there were no vowel markers to indicate the sound, we should have to be taught, like the Jews, which word the writer intended. Actually, so an older Jewish person back in the old days would teach the younger rabbis and teachers how to pronounce each word and what this word meant and what that word meant, because the vowel markers weren't invented until later. So so they had to learn. The learning of the Jews was actually they had to be taught how to read their text and what each word meant, even though, like with us, we, you know, if I learn how to read English, I don't have to have somebody tell me how to read it. Unless I find a Greek word, whatever, like we were dealing with just a minute ago. But in Hebrew, since it was mostly consonants, whatever, they had to have somebody tell them, okay, this word means this, because like you can have three letters that are all the same, but they all mean different things because of the context and because of the fact that they didn't have vowel markers. Anyway, here, for example, the two Hebrew words in Deuteronomy, BZR and PSGH, Pisgah, which our Hebrew Bible reads as Bezor and Pisgah. Ha, I was right. But which the Septuagint translators rendered as Bozar and Pasgah, old documents, a new Bible. Oh, that was a quote, I guess. Oh, let's see. Vowels were not even used until about the 7th and 8th century. Syriac and Arabic writings had a similar delay for vowels in their writings. Many Bible difficulties resulted from minor errors on the part of the copyist in the transmission of texts. In the Old Testament, since transmissional errors may have resulted from a poor reading of the vowels, Hebrew was originally written with consonants only, and the vowel signs were not added until thousands of years after the completion of the Old Testament canon. But there are also some consonants that are easily confused because they look so much alike. Besides that, some words are preserved in a very old spelling, susceptible of misunderstanding by later Hebrew copyists. End quote. Bible Difficulties, Gleason L. Archer, page 16. Number 15, continuous letters. Another cause of errors in translating ancient texts was the dividing of words that have been written that had been originally all run together in a continuous line. For example, come see a man which told me all things whatsoever I did, and that's all in one word, right? Because they didn't put spaces in it. Etzenhauser gives an a simple explanation of this particular method of mistranslation. Again, in ancient manuscripts, where there is often no division between words, each line presenting a continuous row of letters, it might easily happen that one word would be wrongfully divided into two, or two combined into one, as in the Old Testament, or in the old story of the infidel who wrote over his bed, "God is nowhere." Sorry, my studio timed out. I'm just watching the studio in case we have any callers. Let's see here. As in the old story of the infidel who wrote over his bed, "God is nowhere," which was read by his little boy as, "God is now here." Oh, that's interesting. Now here, nowhere. And quote, old documents in the Bible, pages 20 and 21, verse 6, topic 6, or point 16. Language variants. Aramaic is a kindred language to Hebrew, and about 500 BC it became the spoken language of the common man around Palestine. Since Aramaic spoken by most Jews several centuries before Christ, it explains why the Old Testament portions are found written in the Aramaic language. Even the appearance of the Aramaic and the Hebrew letters are almost identical, and yet there are two different languages. The Aramaic language was used for many centuries and was the written and spoken language of Messiah and his disciples. However, although Aramaic was spoken by Messiah, the books of the New Testament were usually written in Greek, as the writer wanted to translate into a more commonly used language. In the first century, Greek was the universal language, such as English today is fairly universal around the world. Since the Bible was mostly written in these three languages, we have three variants of expression and interpretation. I'm going to have to leave it at that. I think we've only got a couple minutes. Well, let me see how far we've got. I know I'm going to have to do a part two and possibly a part three with this. I just want to make sure I'm not just cutting it off right before the end, because I've done that before, like where I'm like, okay, I can't deal with this. I got 90 seconds left on the live streaming portion of the radio program anyway. So, and oh my gosh, I am so tired. I like this week. So my wife got a job. Okay. So this year, I drive a semi-truck for the power plants hauling coal from the mine to the power plants. And there was a mine collapse. Nobody got killed, luckily, but there was some unstable stuff going on. Plus, the longwall move was down, and they were having all kinds of problems. And I actually got laid off twice this year. In the spring. Excuse me. I think it was for 10 weeks. I can't remember. And so I was on unemployment twice. And we already are living paycheck to paycheck anyway, because I don't make a whole lot as it is. And so it was really a difficult thing for us to have to go through that. Well, my wife decided, she has a bachelor's degree, and she wanted to wait until the youngest was in kindergarten before she went back to work. She used to teach in a private school. Well, she decided that she could do her job, and I could stay home with the kids, which I love driving trucks, so I wouldn't want to do that. But my boss wants me to work for full time, of course. Well, my wife got a job teaching kindergarten, which I'm really proud of her about. Like, and she loves it. She's such a good teacher. She's so good with little kids. And so I've been coming home or getting off at 5:30 in the morning and coming home, and she wakes up at 5:30. I get home around 6 and I help her get ready for her job by getting all the food and everything ready and helping her do whatever she needs. And then she leaves at 6:30, or like today she left a little bit late. But it's a 45-minute drive over to where she works. So she has to leave way early in the morning, and then I have to stay awake and make sure the kids get off to school and then take them to school. And then I have to do all this other stuff, like go to the health department and get birth certificates and immunization records and go talk to the school, whoever, nurse or just all this stuff. And so the other day I got home at 5:30 in the morning and I worked for like 10 to 12 hours, I think. But I got home at 5:30 in the morning. I didn't even get into bed until 3:30 in the afternoon. And then yesterday, I got home at 5:30, but I didn't get to bed till like 10:30. And so I'm like really tired because of this, and maybe I should go part-time, but my boss is like, we really need you to help us because we're having these problems and the financial, like, work, we can't pay the bills for the fuel, and like, because they're still scrambling and trying to figure out what, you know, because we got laid off and they still had to make payments on these trucks and trailers. So anyway, so my boss wants me to work like, oh, get as many loads as you can. And like, I'm like, okay, well, I got to help my wife. And then like, I don't see my wife for more than like 10, 15 minutes in the afternoon. So anyway, so I'm really tired and I'm just going to have to come back on this as a part two. And I'll get these up on Facebook and also, YouTube as a video, and we'll be coming back later with a part 2 and 3 and possibly part 4. I am going to go to bed as soon as I get my little girl off to school, and I'll wake up later and it will be Shabbat because we still observe the proper Jewish, actually Hebrew, Sabbath, which starts tonight at sundown. And no revelation ever changed that for all these people, that other than a revelation from the devil through the Catholic Church. So anyway, and if you want to know more about the true Sabbath, you can actually find that on youtube.com/God, our user /God is my compass. And I've put, teachings on my wall. And you can scroll down to the True Sabbath, which is 3 videos that are on a playlist that I created, which are 3 hours and 33 minutes long. So I go through a lot of stuff there. Anyway, I got to go because I am going to fall asleep. And thank you for watching this video, and thank you for listening to the podcast, Fundamentally Mormon, by Mark Wickenwalter, who I am. So anyway, I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you for watching. Take care, everyone. Shalom.